Hey, welcome along. It's another one of our live Clubland Q&A sessions around the planet, 4 p.m. Eastern Time in North America, which means it's, what is that, 9 p.m. British Summer Time or 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, if you're trying to work it out in relation to your own time zone. That means 10 p.m. Tuesday night in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in the Middle East, midnight in Moscow, and an early Wednesday morning for most of our Asian listeners and our Western Australian ones. We're slightly more of a civilized hour in Eastern Australia, New Zealand, and the rest of the Pacific. And setting aside Wednesday morning, it's Tuesday, September the 11th in the United States. And this is the 17th anniversary of 9/11. And we're going to talk a bit about that and the big picture arising therefrom on today's show. To ask a question, all you got to do is put it in the comment box at this particular page at steinonline.com if you're a Mark Stein Club member. And if you're not a Mark Stein Club member, you can join right now and pop the question. Put a question to me right now on the air, because we always like to get a couple of questions from brand new club members. And it's fun in the Mark Stein Club, where we have we got a brand new Tale for Our Time, our monthly audio adventures that will be starting this Friday. And we got a cruise coming up at the end of the month at the height of fall foliage season. We'll be sailing from Montreal down the St. Lawrence and down the beautiful eastern seaboard to Boston with me and my special guests, and if you'd like to come along on that, we'd certainly welcome your company. As I said, it's the 17th anniversary of 9/11, and I mentioned this time last year that we don't do what we used to do. I used to post the columns I'd written on that day and the 48 hours or so afterwards. And in fact, I have a book that is contains most of those columns. An anthology of my writing from the first year of that war, from September 11th, 2001 to September 11th, 2002. And I don't do it anymore. I think that book, The Face of the Tiger, actually pretty much gets the general vibe, the issues, the context, the mood of that immediate post-9/11 period. We used to call it back then The Day That Everything Changed. And then somehow a few years later, I noticed that everything changed back, and we seem to be living in September the 10th, only more so. All the things that briefly seemed up for play in the weeks and months after 9/11, things like political correctness, being honest about existential issues like immigration and that kind of thing, We seem to turn back to September the 10th, only more so. So to the point where in some ways we're living in an Uber September the 10th. And I find the observances now a bit too passive, a bit too sober, a bit too accepting of that world of September the 10th. 3,000 people died that day. 1,700 have died of cancer from the toxic dust blown throughout Manhattan when those towers fell. So that, if you go by what the lawyers call chain of causation, that is really 4,700 fatalities arising from what America's enemies did on that day. And I think sometimes back to the way I felt at the time, I remember it very clearly. I don't have any interesting personal stories to tell about that day. I heard on the radio that the first plane had hit, and then about 15 minutes later that the second plane had hit, at which point it became clear that it wasn't an accident and something was going on. And I switched on the television, and my main memory of that morning is that I was watching the smoking tower and I had some guy delivering a sofa that day. So the door, there's a knock on the door and a couple of guys come in and they've got a sofa and we're talking to the guy and saying, stick the sofa over there and all the rest of it. And I turn away from the TV for a moment where the skyscraper is smoking and the guy sets down the sofa and I turn back to the TV and the building has gone. The building has gone. And I remember some of the victims that day. I remember especially the young victims. There was a little girl from Massachusetts, Christine Hansen. She was 2 years old. She was on the United flight out of Boston. She was sitting between her parents. And the flight was headed to Los Angeles, where Mr. and Mrs. Hansen were planning to take little Christine to Disneyland. 2 years old. I remember I had just become a father myself, and I was in a. It had an odd effect on me. I couldn't stand to go to movies where children died, or even where children were threatened with violence. It sort of would make me tear up in the movies. It was a strange thing, and so I was particularly moved by the stories of the young victims of 9/11, and in a way it was too vivid. It was clear that her father, Christine's father, knew what was going on. He placed a cell phone call to Christine's grandfather, his own father, who was a World War II veteran somewhere in Connecticut, I think, and told him, I think they're going to crash the plane. He knew that. His wife knew that. And somehow they had to keep their little girl calm and thinking she was just on a normal airplane flight for her first visit to Disneyland in California. And all that is still very vivid with me. But as I said, somehow the day that everything changed back. And I don't know what this war is meant. It's still a hot war. We're still running around Afghanistan. I've no idea why. The Taliban control more territory than they have at any point since the fall of 2001 when we went in there. We've been running around for 17 years holding less and less land. Prominent Australian politician. I was having a conversation with him about his own visit to visit Australian troops there. And he said, it's like Crusader forts. You know, inside you got your Burger King and your Dunkin' Donuts. You step outside, you would never know we were there. I mean, yes, you would. We built schoolhouses. We'd spend a lot of money building schoolhouses for Afghan schoolchildren so that when the Taliban take them over, they can ban girls from those schoolhouses and they can teach hardcore Islam in American taxpayer-funded buildings. By the way, that just doesn't happen in Afghanistan. One of the hardcore last-minute issues, as it were, in the Swedish election on Sunday was when I believe it was the Liberal Party leader, came out against Salafist schools funded by public monies in Sweden, not in Helmand province, not in Kandahar. But the Swedish taxpayer is paying for public schools in Sweden where they teach so-called Swedish, unquote, Muslims, Salafist Islam, the most hardcore radical form of Islam. And Swedish taxpayers think it speaks well for them that they're prepared to pay for Swedish Muslims to be inculcated in an ideology that almost ensures they will loathe and despise modern Sweden. Same thing's happening in France, where they've got Salafist teachings at public expense in French schools, and they're saying, well, the solution to that is to teach them more Arabic and all the rest of it. I don't think any of this is where any of us thought we would be 17 years ago. So we're going to take your questions on that subject and the big picture and the broader picture as we go on today's show. Quinn Watson writes, Mark, on this 17th anniversary, it's useful to reflect on the strategy embarked by the Bush administration in the immediate aftermath. One has to wonder where we would be today if we had never devoted so much American blood and treasure to oust Saddam Hussein. Sure, he was a bad guy, but there are a lot of terrible dictators the world around that we've not ousted. I think Bush did a good job in the years after 9/11 when he had the hardest job in the world, but would we have been better served to focus 100% of our resources solely on hunting down al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan? I sometimes wonder if we could have gotten bin Laden several years sooner, spared many US soldier and Iraqi civilian lives, and prevented the rise of ISIS had we taken this course of action instead of invading Iraq. I don't know about hunting down bin Laden throughout Afghanistan and Pakistan. It depends what you think this war is about. I will say this, that the going back to what I said, this is in the book I mentioned, The Face of the Tiger, that the war was hobbled, the hot war. There's two wars going on, really. There's a hot war that we're fighting in Afghanistan and, you know, the Islamic State and Libya and Yemen and Sudan and wherever's next. And then there's the Cold War, which is the gradual surrender, peaceful demographic surrender of large chunks of what we used to call Christendom to the House of Islam, the Dar al-Islam. And, you know, I don't find it hard. I mean, in the end, if Afghans want to live under the Taliban, good luck to them. What do I care? But I do very much care about the heart of Europe being surrendered to Islam. I think that's a tragedy. So just to deal with the hot war thing very quickly, it was hobbled by political correctness from the beginning. The very first night of the Afghan war, I had a conversation with Don Rumsfeld about this, the U.S. Defense Secretary, a couple of years later after this happened. But on that very first night of the Afghan war, 17 years ago, a drone had Mullah Omar and his top leadership from the Taliban fleeing their compound. The drone had them in the sights and was about to vaporize them. The one-eyed Mullah, he used to be a famous guy, Mullah Omar, and the guy who did it, and we could have killed the guy on the first night, and then they get a thing from Central Command in Florida. Oh, wait a minute, my JAG doesn't like this. The JAG is an army lawyer. That's what a JAG is. And he didn't want to sign off on this. And so Mullah Omar got away and died peacefully. And you can't fight a war like that. Rumsfeld was hopping mad when he heard about it. And a couple of years later, when I happened to be meeting him, I reminded him of that. And he was still hopping mad about it. Because it actually communicated something to the world, that even though there were 3,000 people dead and a smoking hole in Lower Manhattan, in the end, we weren't really serious about it. Oh, no, the JAG isn't happy about droning Mullah Omar, so the drone isn't allowed to strike him. So it's a lawyer's war. It's a lawyer's war. It's a rules of engagement war. And here we are 17 years later, and we've done it the JAG's way. We've had a lawyer's war for 17 years, and it's going nowhere. That's why it takes so long, by the way. When you let lawyers run anything, it's like my Michael Mann case in Washington. It never ends, whether it's the Michael Mann case or the Afghan war. Andrew A. writes, Mark, how far should a responsible, ordinary citizen go towards educating himself about the true nature of Islam and jihad that motivates these attacks, as opposed to highlighting the weak political and cultural response on our side? Which is worse, our own stupidity or the evil of the jihadists? Well, I said this in my book, America Alone, in 2006. Islam, so-called, however you want to define that, you want to qualify, you want to put radical Islam, you want to call it Islamism, you want to, you know, you want to qualify it any which way you want. However you formulate it, it's an opportunist infection. It wouldn't be able to have advanced and to be able to prosecute its goals so easily if we weren't the pitiful creatures that we are, if we didn't suffer from a kind of civilizational ennui. I mean, essentially, we're bored with ourselves, and that's why we fetishize things like diversity. And so Islam has been one of the reasons, I think, is that one of the consequences of 9/11 is that it got our attention. And in fact, if you look at it in a macro civilizational Samuel Huntington type sense, it's best not to get our attention. It's like, so Islam plays a kind of good cop, bad cop strategy. The bad cops are not just the fellas like Osama when they have the big attacks like 9/11 or the Bali bombings or the London Tube or Madrid or whatever, but also these little rinky-dink guys who just get a rental car and ride it up onto the sidewalk and kill half a dozen people, which happens all over the place. Although ones who don't even want to pay $30 to rent some compact vehicle, but instead get a kitchen knife and just go all stabby-stabby in the shopping mall, and they may kill one or two or three, and then they'll injure, eight or nine other people. And that's the bad cop end of it. The good cop end of it, which is much more effective, at least when you look at what's happened since 9/11, is people who say, is the guys who say, what are you doing flying planes into skyscrapers? The infidels are so stupid, they're going to hand us the keys to those skyscrapers. Why knock down what's going to be our real estate in a few years? And you see that in what's going on in Europe. I mentioned these taxpayer-funded Salafist schools. You certainly wouldn't want to fly planes into those buildings. The infidel taxpayer is paying for the most radical imams from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and Iran to radicalize Swedish and French school children. You certainly wouldn't want to fly a plane into that building because it's not even the old Stalinist line. Where they say the West will sell us the rope by which we will hang them. We're actually subsidizing the rope by which these guys are hanging us. So I do regard us, in a sense, as the primary problem there. David Taylor says, there can be no peace until all Muslims renounce jihad. But because Islam is an ideology of conquest and inherently supremacist, that cannot happen. I think often of the Muslim protest outside Westminster Abbey and Mark's rejoinder asking who would like to join him at the counter-protest in Mecca outside the Grand Mosque. Thank you for remembering the throwaway lines, David. I think it was actually Westminster Cathedral because I think they were protesting Pope Benedict. Threatening to kill Pope Benedict, as is their wont, of course. And of course, because we like to celebrate diversity, we think it's entirely fine for them to threaten to kill Pope Benedict, who, of course, has now resigned and been replaced by this social justice pope. As you say, we're in a sort of contradiction here because we're asking something of Islam that by definition it cannot do. Everybody talks like this, but President Obama will do as a typical example. After the San Bernardino killings at a Christmas party, where this couple who'd met essentially at an Islamic dating site that sort of functions as a cell formation operation. So this is where the guy had met his wife, and it all goes swimmingly because they both want to kill infidels, so they're perfectly matched. And then they start killing them at this Christmas party in San Bernardino. And President Obama, at his most professorial, assures us that this chap and his wife don't, quote, don't speak for Islam. They don't speak for Islam. Great. Who does actually speak for Islam? You know, because for 17 years now, we've heard President Obama and to a degree President Bush before him, and we've heard Theresa May and David Cameron and John Kerry and Angela Merkel and Malcolm Turnbull down in Australia and Western leaders all over the map assuring us that whoever's going all stabby-stabby in the shopping mall or who's putting the pedal to the metal as he goes down the sidewalk, whoever it is, they don't speak for Islam. So we've got a huge long list of people who don't speak for Islam. And we've got an extremely short list, once you discount John Kerry and Barack Obama and so, we've got an extremely short list of people who do speak for Islam. And I think it's, I think at a certain point, the silence is the response. Again, it's another great Rumsfeld line. The absence of evidence is also evidence, one of Rummy's favorite lines. And so just as Western leaders keep assuring us that this great long list of stabbers and vehicular homicide enthusiasts and self-detonating bombers and whatever it is, none of them speak for Islam. All the people who supposedly do speak for Islam, their silence, in fact, becomes a very eloquent statement. Alman from CA says, "Hi, Mark. Since 9/11, the increasingly hard left has accepted Islam into their alignment of various victim groups. Do the leftists, American and European alike, really think that by proactively defending Islam now, they won't be targeted like the rest of us infidels if Islam ever took over?" Well, I take your point. I mean, because the thing is, This seems at a certain level as incoherent. It seems like the sort of dinner theatre version of the Hitler-Stalin pact. Because if you're a feminist, they're going to put you in a body bag. Islam wants to put you in a body bag. If you are gay, they want to throw you off a tall building or burn you to death. So in a sense, it's an entirely incoherent coalition. But I think that overlooks what they do have in common. And what they have, I'll add one thing, actually, which is very striking. One thing that these groups do agree on, actually, is a general antipathy to Jews, for example. So, for example, when people point out the incoherence of the British left being hot for Islam. Actually, the one point, as Laura Rosen Cohen, whose blog I miss and used to enjoy tremendously, used to say that where all these groups meet is at Jew Hate Junction, and that's true. But it's also, I think, you can see this already. You can see it happening before your eyes. You can see it happening not just in the UK Labour Party, but you can see it happening in continental Europe too. They're actually prepared to trade. In the end, the institutional left and Islam like telling people what they have to do. They like telling people how to live their lives. And if you have a taste for big government and an overpowering authority that tells you what to do, in the end, the pleasure you take in telling people what to do is more important than precisely what it is you're telling them to do. And so when Islam, right now at the moment, you can have, you can be feminist, gay, transgendered or whatever. And that's the muscle in much of the Western world. So people who like telling people what to do say, no. No, you can't call transgendered people by the wrong pronoun. You've got to use these pronouns and that pronouns. And there's not two sexes anymore. There's 157 genders. And if you deny that, we're going to get you fired from your job. And what's the fun in that? Are you really that concerned about the intersexuals and the pansexuals and the two-spirited and whatever's next down the pike? Or is the real frisson, is the real turn-on to you telling people what to do? At that point, when Islam becomes the muscle, that's the hellish thing about where we are 17 years on. This is in my book too, 2006, about America alone. In 2006, I wrote this. It's in that book about it, writing about a prominent white supremacist who converted to Islam. Why? If he's a white supremacist, why would he get mixed up with a lot of people who have very different hues compared to the people he mixed with when he was a white supremacist? Well, because in the end, the white bit was less important than the supremacist bit. And I think we already see the way that's going, the way they're surrendering the pass. When you look at the way the gay pubs in the East End of London are closing down, the gay bars in Amsterdam are closing down, the way it's not safe for women to walk around in certain French cities. In the end, they're like that guy. It's the supremacist bit they like. So when Islam becomes supremacist, they'll convert and they'll like that too. Charles Moritz, I don't know whether he says Moritz or Moritz. If I'm mispronouncing it, Charles, I apologize. Charles says, do American Muslims think of themselves as apostates? If Islam is a theocracy, how do they rationalize the separation of church and state? Thanks, Charlie. Well, if you look at them in there, if you take a lot of prominent American Muslims like Linda Sarsour, you can find statements they make that are very supportive of Sharia. And if you take the union of in Islam, where Islam is not just a religion, but the source of law, then obviously there's an element of humbug that attaches to professions of allegiance to the United States Constitution. And that goes for a lot of other people in a lot of who exist in a slightly equivocal relationship, poised somewhere between church and state. But I think there's another element to it with Muslims, is that in a sense, what matters is whether there's any sort of countervailing balance. We're starting a new tale for our time, actually, on this theme, broadly speaking, this Friday. And one of the fascinating things about that is that people understood the potential danger of Islam 100 years ago. And if you remember my remarks on stage at the monk debate, I mentioned sort of more or less en passant that more Muslims fought for king and empire in both the First and Second World Wars than Canadians did. And the reason, and so that kind of seems odd to us now. For example, in the modern era, there are more British Muslims, so-called, fighting for the Islamic State than there are British Muslims serving in the British Army. So something has changed between the First and Second World Wars and now. And what's changed is us. It comes back to that question of what's more at issue. The countervailing forces that held Islam in check were real throughout most of the past 200 years, whether you're talking about the British Raj in India, whether you're talking about the Soviet Union in the Central Asian stans, or Tito in Yugoslavia, or the Indonesian dictatorship. All these old school British colonialism in Sudan. Now, none of these things are terribly attractive to an American mindset, which is why the Afghan adventure is a complete waste of time. Because Americans are not in the imperialism business. So the idea that you would spend 17 years in Afghanistan, but we would never once even try to say, no, we're doing it our way. Otherwise, why are we here? Why are we building schoolhouses to teach the most ugly and repressive form of Islam? Why would we do that? Why would we do that and then stick Mr. and Mrs. Smith in Idaho with the bill for it? Well, because Americans don't have an imperialist bone in their body. Those countervailing forces that I mentioned, whether it's the Soviet Union or the British Raj, or the Indonesian dictatorship, Tito in Yugoslavia, whatever, were real. And it would be lovely, delightful, if we could get back to that. But the problem now is that lots of things have changed in the world, including social media. And I think it actually makes it's possible now to live with a global Islamic identity, whether you're someone in Yorkshire, whether you're someone in Vermont, whether you're someone in Gothenburg, Sweden, or Toulouse in France, to live with a global Islamic identity in a way that would not have been possible just a few years ago. And that's an issue. Mark Farigno wrote, Mark, 17 years since 9/11 and 17 years in Afghanistan, the left used to be all about an exit strategy. We never hear about exit strategies anymore. Will the US ever leave Afghanistan? Well, the funny thing is, every time it comes up, and President Trump, for example, knows it's a complete waste of time. That's his instinct. He sits in a room with generals and politicians explaining to him why we can't leave because of this, because of that. And he keeps saying, well, wait a minute, what are our war aims there? Why are we there? Are we going to win? Do we still have win as or not? When they send you the options for the war and it says win, lose, dither around for 17 years, dither around for 27 years, dither around for 47 years, do they still have a win box on there? Because his instincts are to get the hell out. And yet it's fascinating to me that whenever we actually... We seem to understand, we seem to sort of discern in some way that the final verdict on the futility has to keep, that can has to be kicked down the road. There are consequences to this. There was a Sergeant Major Bolliard who was killed there a few days ago, and I said on Rush, on America's number one radio show just last week, it's the 17th anniversary of 9/11. That means that sometime in 2019, 2020, maybe if we're lucky, 2021, the first U.S. soldier to be born after 9/11 is going to be killed in Afghanistan. Think back to that little girl, Christine Hansen, 2 years old. She would be 19 now had she lived. We have grown old as she did not. And people who were not born that day are now 17 years old. And next year, the year after, some of those people are going to be signing up and going off to fight in the 18th, 19th, 20th year of an Afghan war. Joseph Huber writes, Hi Mark, I just read where the Muslim Council of Britain, joined by three members of parliament, is trying to have Franklin Graham, that's Billy Graham's son, barred from entering Britain. Apparently he is Islamophobic and has no right to walk among the Brits. Not meaning to diminish the suffering of 9/11 in any way, I think the fact that this is even being considered shows the Islamists have waged a far more effective war against the UK and Europe than they did against us on 9/11. Do you foresee a time when the people of Britain reclaim their heritage, or has PC and immigration tipped the scales too far already for that to happen, says Joseph. Well, Joseph, back when I was fighting the free speech battles with the human rights commissions in Canada, and my comrade in that battle was Ezra Levant, who was the publisher of the Weekly Standard at that time, which is the only publication that republished the Danish Mohammed cartoons, except for Charlie Hebdo, I believe, and I think somewhere in Norway. I may be wrong on that, maybe doing an injustice. But anyway, you know, the Times of London didn't, and the Washington Post didn't, and Le Monde didn't, just small peripheral publications. And Ezra remarked that one day the Danish Mohammed cartoons would come to be seen as a more consequential event than 9/11. And he doesn't mean, you know, that five Danish cartoonists are more important than 3,000 or 4,700 corpses in Lower Manhattan. What he meant is that something like 9/11 is an obvious provocation. They blow up, they destroy your buildings in the heart of your great cities and leave thousands of dead. And you have to do something. It doesn't matter who's president. It doesn't matter whether it's President Nancy Pelosi or President Bernie Sanders or whoever. You have to do something. But something like the Danish Mohammed cartoons is slyer and subtler, and it's more slippery. And Ezra was right to the extent that we have been willing to surrender core Western liberties, particularly on free speech. So now they're proposing that a citizen of a friendly nation can be banned, not a man of violence, not like all the stupid imams they let in, not like all the stupid refugees. That's the other thing about Afghanistan. Fascinating thing about Afghanistan is we've been there for 17 years and we've built such a paradise that every day you can pick up a Western newspaper and read about some Afghan who's killing your citizens, not in Kandahar, not in Jalalabad, but in the heart of the West. Just in the last couple of days, some Afghan refugee stabbed a bunch of people in Paris. Another a Afghan refugee, so-called, murdered a guy. Three Afghan refugees were harassing a young girl in Germany, and a young man in Eastern Germany, young man intervened and died. A couple of American tourists attacked by another Afghan refugee in Amsterdam. It doesn't really matter. Don't worry about it. If you missed that story, didn't catch, there'll be another one along in 20 minutes. Funnily enough, as I said, since we built a paradigm, we spent 17 years building utopia in Afghanistan, and all these Afghans, oddly enough, who never wanted to leave under the Taliban and all the other loonies afflicting them since the toppling of King Zahir in the 70s, all these Afghans who put up with all the nutty regimes since then, the Americans and their allies come along, they can't wait to get the hell out of the place and come to Europe and start stabbing Europeans. To go back to what you were saying, Joseph, we've got no problem letting in all these people. But Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, no, we can't. He said some things. And again, I think about what's changed. I think back to that line of Ezra's about the Danish Mohammed cartoons are in the long run more consequential. I remember the immediate aftermath of 9/11 in the papers. I wrote in a lot of Canadian, UK, Australian papers all over the world. And in those days, I still used to keep them in hard copy. And I remember, for example, a cartoon in the Telegraph. Most of us, for example, hadn't been paying a lot of attention to Islam. So we were kind of, everyone was getting up to speed on Islam in September and October of 2001. And one of the things a cartoon that appeared in the Telegraph showed a woman in a burqa. We all thought, because we were trying to figure out Afghanistan. And yeah, you had a few burqas on the streets of Western cities, but nothing like it is now. And so Taliban Afghanistan was burqa central. And so you see all these scenes from Afghanistan, these women in burqas, and it seems wacky. And we were allowed to say it was wacky back then. And there was a cartoon in the Telegraph in London. I wrote for the Telegraph back then. And it said, it's a woman in a burqa trying on a new burqa in a some sort of burqa clothing store. And she's saying to her friend, it's a joke, it's a play on words based on the joke about, you know, two English girls trying on clothes in Richard Shops or Marks and Spencers or wherever it is in the changing room, and one saying to the other, does my bum look big in this? And instead, the woman in the burqa is saying to her friend, does my bomb look big in this? Okay, it's actually a pretty funny joke, you know, because it's like they just like having the old suicide bomber belt underneath the burqa. And instead of saying, does my bum look big in this? She's saying, does my bomb look big in this? You know, you couldn't put that joke in the Telegraph now. And in fact, a Telegraph columnist, old friend of mine, former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, he didn't even do the does my bomb look big in this joke. He actually just said that he didn't like seeing burqas because they looked like letterboxes. And he's in trouble. The Tory party wants to send him to re-education camp for not for saying does my bomb look big in this and implying that Muslim women are inclined to blow up buildings. But just for saying he doesn't like burqas as an item of fashion, calling them a letterbox. The episode, if you ever watch the Australian, what's it called, Crownies, which is about young Crown solicitors, which is like the equivalent of, the county attorney or the district attorney in the American system. This thing, Crownies, which is about young Crown solicitors in Sydney. And they go into court one day and the judge is sitting there and the witness is wearing a burqa. And the lady judge says she has to lose the letterbox. The letterbox, the thing that Boris Johnson got into trouble for. Just a few years ago, you could actually do that on Australian TV. The jokes from the post-9/11 era, and this is why it's lost. Joseph, because what they're telling you is you don't have to agree with what Franklin Graham says about Islam, but if being reported as saying this or that about Islam is going to get you banned from going not to Saudi Arabia, but get you banned from going to the United Kingdom or to France or to Italy, then the obvious effect on that, because most people want a quiet life, is that people are not going to say anything about Islam. And that actually, that's the difference between the good cop, bad cop strategy. The good cop strategy, just portraying Muslims as a victim group and demanding extraordinary protections from the general rough and tumble of free societies is actually far more disturbing. George Pereira writes, do you know what happened to that unhappy JAG, the one who prevented us droning Mullah Omar on the first day of the Afghan war? No, I don't, George, but we'll see if we can find out about that. Carmen writes, Mark, how do we make our so-called leaders and the mainstream media call and face Islamist terrorism for what it really is, so that we can actually start to combat it effectively? How do we stop the relentless infiltration and influence of Muslim Brotherhood connected persons into all levels of government and major institutions? You know what's horrible about this is that at a certain level, they understand. The first thing that Western leaders did after 9/11 was to hustle to a mosque so they could stand there being photographed with imams saying Islam is a religion of peace. And so many of those connections, all the people George W. Bush stood next to, Tony Blair stood next to, extraordinary percentage of them turned out to have terrorist connections, including the big shot we wound up killing over in Yemen, who's behind a lot of things, including the Fort Hood thing. Because in the end, and the Fort Hood thing actually gets to the mindset, the chief of staff of the United States Army at a U.S. military base, he's got 13 dead Americans. Because a military psychologist has opened fire and killed them. And he says, as great a tragedy as this was, an even greater tragedy would be if we were to lose our diversity. This guy is the only mass murderer in American history who gave a PowerPoint presentation to his superiors on what he was planning to do. And they all put that down. Oh, isn't that nice? He's very diverse. Yes, I know this would seem disturbing if, say, an evangelical Christian were to start saying stuff like this. But no, we celebrate diversity, and this guy seems awfully diverse, so let's just let him get on with it. It's a sickness. It's a sickness. It's a sickness embedded so deep in the establishments of Western countries that they can't change their mind. All that can I'll add a qualification to that. But generally speaking, they can't. They won't. They're too invested in it because it means writing off half a century of public policy as madness. So all that can happen is what's been happening in Europe, where the so-called populist candidates who don't want anything to do with semi-Muslim societies, get elected. For, you know, Hungary, Austria, Italy, edging ever closer to the critical axis in continental Europe, which is the Franco-German axis. Now, aside from that, you've had things, what's going on in Scandinavia, where the Swedish election at the weekend was a very typical example. The so-called populist guy didn't win. There was a lot of talk he might be the biggest party. There was a lot of talk that he might clear 20%. In the end, I think he got 17.8 or something. So everyone was able to say, well, the hard right anti-immigration party didn't clear 20%, didn't be. It's only the third biggest party, not the first. So, but what was interesting about that was, in that final leadership debate, all the other leaders, didn't matter whether they were liberal, conservative, social democrat, Christian democrat, whatever, were all saying things that only 5 years ago they would have regarded as hate crimes. So it was a classic example of the Milton Friedman thing, saying don't wait for someone to come along to do the right thing. Persuade the wrong people that it's in their interest to do the right thing. And that Swedish leadership debate, the wrong people were suddenly all saying the right thing on immigration and very odd. Rich writes, hi, Mark, love the club, not listening in until later, so I apologize if you've covered anything below. The war on terror, now there's a quaint phrase. Seems to me fighting a war on terror while having open borders is like turning on the AC but keeping a window open. I don't think Trump is our savior, but he is the only politician who has had the guts to not allow the multicultural coexist crowd walk over him and the career political class hate him for it. In terms of strategy, it seems to me as if we've spent the past 15 plus years trying to kill this guy or get this group out of that region, but almost no time trying to prevent the next terror cell from popping up. As a result, we end up occupying everything in perpetuity. I'd argue that no matter how thick our rose-coloured glasses, certain cultures, groups or religions would always hate one another. So the idea that we can win any war on terrorism is absurd. But let's do the easy thing and suppose I'm wrong. How would you recommend we put an end to all terrorism? Or are you with me and think it's a pipe dream? Well, Rich, you're right. The war on terror was an evasion, and it was a conscious evasion. Because on the morning of September the 12th, George W. Bush and his principal advisors, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, everyone was very conscious that if there were to be any military operations, they were going to be waged in, just to get into Afghanistan, for example, they needed the cooperation of Pakistan and Uzbekistan. So they're going to be in Muslim countries. And they didn't feel it's useful to tell the entire Muslim world, to give the impression to the entire Muslim world, we're at war with you. And so they invented this thing called the War on Terror. And as you say, having a war on terror while having open borders, as Rich puts it, is like turning on the air conditioning but keeping a window open. No matter how much you crank up, I would argue, actually, that the better way to put it is actually like in the depths of winter, when it's 40 below outside and you've got the furnace running full blast and you got the windows open, because then everything you do is just bleeding away outside, and you're trying to do something that's impossible and contradictory. And almost all the people who were most influential, we've just seen extraordinary procession of public obsequies for John McCain, who's the poster child for this boots on the ground everywhere, but open borders at home. So in other words, in order to secure the planet, American soldiers have to be not just in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also in Syria and Libya and Yemen and Somalia and Sudan and forever and ever. But at the same time, we have open borders. So we have got this stupid world now where we're on orange alert. And there's a point I'll make when we introduce our tale for our time on Friday about this, because it is important. So we all suffer now a degraded life. We're treated like animals if we just want to fly home for Thanksgiving in the United States. But at the same time, millions of people can walk across the southern border, and there's no orange alert there. And no one says at the Rio Grande, oh, sorry, before you can walk into the country, you have to take your shoes off and your coat off, and you can't have more than 3 fluid ounces of whatever. And if you're flying, if you're coming in for Thanksgiving, we're going to confiscate your pumpkin pie because it's not dry enough. So instead of a solid, it counts as the Department of Homeland Security has determined your pumpkin pie is a liquid. Nobody says that to the millions of people who've walked into a country on orange alert since 9/11. That contradiction is bonkers. It's nuts. It's insane. It's the McCain, culture, Andrew Breitbart's great insight, and why he was such an effective figure that we miss to this day, was that culture is upstream of politics. Culture trumps politics, which is why Republicans spend their whole time playing catch-up, which is why the definition of a conservative is someone who gets with the program 20 years after the liberal. So, you know, gay marriage, don't go there, girlfriend, it's not the hill to die. Because the left expends its resources changing culture, and the right expends its resources dragging some schmuck over the finish line on a Tuesday evening every other November. And that's Andrew Breitbart's great insight. If you're not playing on the cultural front, you're going to lose. But I'll tell you something else too. Culture trumps not just politics, it trumps war. So expending, billions, trillions of dollars in a worthless place like Afghanistan, while medieval Christmas markets, places that have, towns that have held Christmas markets for 1,500 years, 1,000 years, 900 years, 700 years, and suddenly they cannot hold a Christmas market any longer because the French state can no longer secure the Christmas market. So the Christmas market has to end because the French state cannot distinguish between this awfully pleasant, charming, delightful Muslim and this Muslim who seems awfully charming, delightful, and pleasant, but in his bedroom at night is planning to come and stab you at the Christmas market. Because the French state can't distinguish between them, then that Christmas market has to close. Culture trumps politics, and in the end, culture trumps war. And the war is a sideshow. The rate of Islamic immigration to the West has doubled since 9/11. Fran Lavery writes, "Mark, before reflecting on 9/11, I thought it might be good to review your mailbox video from this past June the 6th. You titled it Dear Prudence, and you tried to explain to Diane Oliver why you used the term imprudence rather than criminal in referring to the policies of the Western governments, which allowed mass immigration from the Middle East and war-torn Muslim countries. I heard Mr. Nigel Farage recently sign off on Tucker's show this summer that freedom is coming back to Europe. Can you explain his comment? Also, what was that large, blurred, black figure in the corner past your right shoulder? Is that a life-size figure of the Grim Reaper or a new robot burqa-clad girl? Burqa Girl is one of my favorite superheroines, Fran. I think it's great that Marvel and DC are now providing positive role models for Muslims in their comic books. So I really like Burqa Girl, and she, of course, is the sidekick to Captain Clitoridectomy. And I think that's what you saw. I think you got a glimpse of Burqa Girl and Captain Clitoridectomy just over my shoulder in that thing. So thank you very much for making that point, friend. Mark, it didn't take much time to bring Muslims to Europe or Hispanics to America over the last few decades. Given the speed of the demographic trends, 2050 being the predicted tipping point, it seems like the change has been cemented. This is from Mingus Parker, by the way, in Los Altos, California. I don't think Mingus Parker is his real name. Because Charlie Mingus, Charlie Parker, what's up with that? Mingus Parker, Parker Mingus, Parker Charlie, Mingus Charlie. I don't know, but I suspect this isn't the real name. Mingus Parker. You can't possibly reverse these demographic changes in the same amount of time. So shouldn't we just accept that in our lifetimes, our grandchildren's lifetimes, and probably great-grandchildren's, Europe will be substantially Muslim? Yes, I think that's true. Basically, as I said, the rate of Muslim immigration to the Western world has doubled since 9/11. That's what changed. And say it was the day that everything changed. Somehow, every president and prime minister in the developed world said, wow, look at that great big smoke and hole in Lower Manhattan. I think this means we need to double the rate of Muslim immigration. And I think back to something Douglas Murray. Douglas Murray has a way of sometimes just saying things to you, little asides that somehow stick in your head. And on the 10th anniversary of the Danish Mohammed cartoons, we were in Copenhagen, we'd given our speeches, we were unwinding, and somebody asked why the Prince of Wales, who's going to be Douglas's king and mine, God help us, is such a sap for Islam. And Douglas talked about when the Prince of Wales had gone to some little Anglican church somewhere. He's going to be head of the Church of England. and Supreme Governor of the Church of England one day, and hopefully not for a few years yet. And he went to this church, little Anglican church. It's like most Anglican churches. People don't go. The few people who do go are extremely elderly. But then someone says, hey, you know who's going to be here on Sunday? Prince Charles. Oh, really? And suddenly he goes and the place is packed. And one result of that is that he walks away thinking that his faith, his world, his civilization is actually much stronger than it is. And that therefore, what's the harm in being generous to Islam? All these poor, broken-down people from loser countries in the desert. Let's be nice to them because we can afford to be. Because he thinks we're in a much stronger situation than we are. And Douglas is mentioning this, and we're all having a bit of a laugh about it. And on the plane, on the way back, I actually think that's how almost all prime ministers and presidents actually look on this, that we're far stronger than we are. Far stronger than we are. Jeffrey Gilbert writes, good afternoon, Mark. I believe it's important to remember, learn, and act from 9/11. However, I resist the urge to define ourselves based on the worst event in our lives and the concurrent guilt and self-loathing that the fault for that event is somehow in ourselves. That seems to be a means of not learning from the event and avoiding actions to prevent similar events in the future. I understand how those that lost lives close to them will always be severely affected. However, as a country, we must be focused on the future. Good. That's true. In fact, there's a one of the annoying things about American bureaucracy is that it's a rear-view mirror bureaucracy. So you have things like the Iraq, the 9/11 Commission, and all the rest of it, and so it really doesn't matter what the event is. People are always actually on the day itself. People were looking at it in Pearl Harbor terms because again they're looking at the rear-view mirror. The forward mirror, if there's such a thing, or what's actually through the front windshield. Windshield, which is it here? Windshield or windscreen? I can never remember. One is US, one is UK. Whichever one it is, if you're looking through the front windshield, windscreen, whatever, what you see ahead is the demographic question, which will determine all. Looking at it through a Pearl Harbor thing, as people did on the day, isn't helpful. Brandy Edwards writes, hi, Mark. It's your Mark Sign Club resident fine girl, Brandy, which, by the way, my parents have assured me I wasn't named after a 1972 Looking Glass song. You could be named, if people are going to name you after songs, as far, you know, you don't begrudge it, Brandy. Adeline. Always liked the name Adeline because of Sweet Adeline. Nobody sings Sweet Adeline anymore, so there's no girls called Adeline anymore, and I miss that because I'd like to be in a singles bar and find myself on the stool next to a girl called Adeline, but there's no Adelines because the whole barbershop quartet scene is dead. But I digress. They named you after the alcohol instead, Brandy. Oh, I didn't know that. So you're like Cognac Edwards. If you were in France. That's good. Classy. On the 9/11 topic, I find it strange that 17 years on, so many countries have chosen to forgive and forget the dangerous ideology that led to the attacks on that day. It's like we've gone backwards in a way, because saying anything negative about Islam or Islamic terror is even more taboo today than it was in 2001. That is a key thought, Brandy. We had much greater freedom of speech on Islam and related subjects 17 years ago than we do today. And you say that's odd because you'd think after America was attacked in such an horrific way, calling out the evil that did this would be a no-brainer. Instead, the law-abiding are forced to go shoeless through airports. We're called racists if we object, while the Islamic terror ideology is alive and well. It's kind of a shame, actually. That's right. We're more constrained in our speech and in basic freedoms. And that is the organ in the panopticon state, the high security state, we'll be monitored 24 hours a day, even as millions of people can pour across the southern border with impunity. On a lighter note, I have a question about your upcoming cruise. I asked you about your sick dog. Since I'm in the same boat, no cruise pun intended, with a very sick dog, I'm super disappointed that I will be unable to go on your cruise. I was wondering if your cruise is going to be a one-time thing or if you are planning to do it again next year. Thank you. Well, no, I think I can pretty much let you in, Brandy, that it's not going to be a one-time thing. And I hope very much that your dog gets well. That's the most important thing. And that your dog will be well enough for you to come on the second Mark Steyn cruise. And I'm sorry that you won't be able to make this one. We will raise a glass of brandy to you. We may even sing the 1972 Looking Glass song, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. And I'm sorry to hear your parents didn't name you after that. Anyway, thank you very much for that question. We'll try and pick up some of the other ones in a special video edition of Mark's Mailbox when we can. But I thank you for your questions and the old clock on the wall. The old clock on the wall, as they say at the BBC, has gone past 5 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That's 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. That's well into the night in Europe and Wednesday morning. And this 17th anniversary of those September 11th attacks has come to an end for much of the planet. We will not forget them. But we should also not forget what they used to call the root causes. And we should think seriously about them. And we should not live in the rearview mirror, but we should keep looking through the front windshield or front windscreen or whatever you call it in your particular part of the world. And we should keep looking at the challenges in the road ahead, because they are actually far more difficult. And they require far more tricky navigation than they did 17 years ago. In many ways, we have squandered the last 17 years. We have wasted the last 17 years, and we have made the cause that much more difficult to prevail. And I don't know where we'll be in another 17 years. I hope to God we're not wasting our time running around Helmand Province and the rest of the Hindu Kush. Although I wouldn't entirely rule it out. But it is time to think seriously, even as we remember the dead, about what lies ahead. This is Mark Steyn. This has been our Clubland Q&A, and I look forward to welcoming you to the Mark Steyn Club, or maybe seeing you next month, at the end of this month, in fact, on that cruise that Brandy mentioned. And don't forget our brand new Tale for Our Time, starting this Friday exclusively at Steyn Online. We'll see you next time.